Well, we do have some preliminaries, so I'm going to begin. Welcome everyone near and far to the Dean's Lecture and Concert Series at St. John's College in Santa Fe. I'm Walter Sterling, the Dean of the College, and it's my more or less weekly pleasure to welcome folks. And we're so excited that we can see students, faculty, alumni, friends of the college near and far and from both of our campuses join us for these events. We have a tradition at the college of not introducing our own. And if we were in the Great Hall, Mr. Slover would just march up and begin. But I like to at least welcome and thank our speakers. So I do welcome this evening Mr. Kit Slover, who is a graduate of the college, who has earned a PhD in philosophy at Emory University, and who has joined us this year as a visiting tutor in Santa Fe. I will add that with his permission, Mr. Slover earlier today, defended his dissertation for his doctorate on a Zoom meeting with the faculty at Emory University. And I'll admit my jaw dropped when I realized the day he was going to be putting in today. So Mr. Slover, I thank you so much for your willingness and your energy and your boldness in having this all happen. Maybe it's the way the planets were meant to align, and maybe you'll make some comments about this in the question period. I also, on a more, not that it's more serious than that, but in a more serious tone, I also want to acknowledge that Mr. Slover is one of our tutors who is leading the way back into in-person classes on our campus. And I say this for folks in our extended community, especially alumni who I know are watching our course through the year here with support and concern. And I just want to, for a moment, again with Mr. Slover's permission, share this photo. Is it up there, Mr. Slover?
Yeah.
Okay. This was, and again, maybe he'll have comments on this, but this was after the first in-person class that we've had in almost a year, since March 13th of last year. January freshmen, the group that we have on campus, who are in Mr. Slover's section, and this was Wednesday a week ago. They went in to do some Euclid on the board, and I think for any true Johnny, the thought of our blackboards lying unused for almost a year and to see Euclid up again, I'll admit to have been very moved and very inspired to see that. So I also just want everyone out there to know that step by step, we are on our way back. I've said many times how proud I've been of the community, more proud than ever at our ability to manage this year despite everything. But it is welcome. It is welcome to start to see the steps that are going to bring us all back home over the coming months and into the next academic year. And I thank you for your role and leadership in that, Mr. Slover. I also want to say it's very welcome to have a Kant lecture as our juniors. And of course, it's no accident, the timing here, as our juniors are on their long journey through Kant. And we think this is particularly nice to have a talk that tries to go right at the heart of this aspect of the Critique of Pure Reason. So having said all of that, will you all please join me in welcoming Kit Slover, whose lecture this evening is titled Self-Consciousness in Kant's Transcendental Deduction of the Categories, What Do We Understand When We Understand? And I will remind you that we are going to go for just under an hour in this format. And then when the lecture concludes, another link was made available and I will reload it in the chat thread near the end of the talk. And we'll resume in a Zoom's meeting for the question period where we can see one another and have a dynamic exchange. And that has been going quite well as we've made the shift into that environment. Okay, Mr. Slover.
Thank you, Mr. Sterling. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this. I'm very excited to be here. Thanks to everybody for joining. Kant on a Friday evening is a big lift, so I appreciate you're taking the time. I included with the lecture link, should have been a handout. If that will come in handy a couple of times throughout the lecture, so if you can have that queued up, and I'll try to indicate when to look at it. Okay, let's rock and roll. After deriving his table of categories in the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant contends that he has successfully listed all the original pure concepts that the understanding contains in itself a priori, so that, quote, by these concepts alone can the understanding think an object, close quote. Whenever we think anything worthy of the name object, Kant suggests, we deploy what he calls the categories to do so. All our thoughtful dealings with the objective world outside us run in some way through these pure concepts of the understanding. But what are the categories? Where do the categories come from? What is Kant's argument for their ancestral primacy and necessary application to the world around us? In this lecture, I will address these questions, exploring Kant's transcendental deduction, the section of the critique in which he attempts to demonstrate that objects, which would seem by definition to have nothing to do with us, are nevertheless required to follow the same laws that govern our thought, namely the categories. I'll begin by discussing the problem of a priori synthesis that gives rise to Kant's general philosophical position of transcendental idealism. From there, I'll discuss the deduction and the way it fits into this general position, showing the human being's act of becoming conscious of herself to play an essential role in making the objects of experience the way they are. After that, I'll argue that for Kant, self-consciousness consists most fundamentally in taking responsibility for what one says, does, and believes. Finally, I'll conclude by using the deduction to address the notorious problem of the thing in itself, arguing that for Kant, this may be understood as an almost ironic term. While the thought of this noumenal object is necessary, the object of this necessary thought does not necessarily exist. Though I hope this study will be of some interest to more seasoned readers of Kant, tutors and seniors, and those who have not yet read him, freshmen and sophomores, the target audience is the junior class who are currently discussing Kant in seminar. The idea is to throw the juniors a bit of a lifeline for understanding this notoriously challenging tour through the understanding, or something to buck against in their own analyses of Kant. So section one, the problem of a priori synthesis and the Copernican turn. Imagine you're on the telephone with your most eccentric friend. She has an array of objects before her and she wants to play a very simple game. Selecting one of her objects, she will tell you its name and ask you a question about it. All you have to do is say whether or not you can answer the question over the phone, just based on its name, without coming over to inspect the object for yourself. So on the handout, if you look at the first section entitled Section 1A, the a priori telephone, she says, the object is a triangle. What color is it? You can't answer. You'd need to have a look at it. How much does it weigh? No clue. How many inches is its base? Impossible to say over the phone. Now she asks, how many sides does it have? That one you can answer. If it's a triangle, it has three sides. What's the sum of its angles? Easy, 180 degrees. Is the exterior angle equal to either of the opposite interior ones? Of course not. Let's think about the questions you cannot answer. Why can't you discern the color of the triangle on the phone? Because triangles can be lots of different colors. A blue triangle is no more or less a triangle than a red one. To know the color of your friend's particular triangle, you'd need to have experience of it yourself. The same goes for the weight and base length. The simple fact that something is a triangle does not tell you anything about how heavy or large it is. Knowledge like this is acquired after, posterior to, experiencing the object with your senses. Call it a posteriori. Now think about the questions you can answer over the phone. Why don't you need to inspect the triangle yourself to know that it has three sides, that its angles add up to 180 degrees? Because these traits pertain to the triangle necessarily. Nothing can be a triangle if it does not have three sides and angles equaling 180. That means you can apply these properties to your friend's triangle without experiencing it with your senses. Knowledge like this may be acquired before, prior to experiencing the object in question with your senses. Call it a priority. Kant's entire interest in the Critique of Pure Reason is with this latter a priori kind of knowledge. Although no one before Kant put it in quite these terms, prior philosophers had implicitly assumed that a priority was always a consequence of what Kant calls analyticity. Any property we may attribute to an object a priori, it was assumed, pertains to that object by definition. So we understand the a priori properties of an object just by analyzing its definition, breaking it down into its parts, and being explicit about what it fully entails. Euclid's definition of a triangle, for example, states that it is a rectilinear trilateral figure. According to the view that Kant contests, everything we can say about triangles a priori is already contained in this definition. Knowing that a triangle's angles add up to 180 is, on this line, just a matter of fully understanding what it takes to be a rectilinear trilateral figure. If we delve deep enough into the definition, the story goes, we'll find everything there is to know about triangles. Kant's inaugural observation in the critique, the big discovery upon which everything else is grounded, is that mathematicians do not, in practice, follow this rule. They act as if there are a great many properties that do not apply to objects by definition, but which we can nevertheless attribute to them a priori. In Kant's terms, when we attribute an a priori property to an object by analyzing its definition, we make an analytic judgment. A judgment is just a complete sentence. Kant thinks some judgments in mathematics are analytic. For example, the claim that a triangle has three sides is certainly contained analytically in the definition of it as a trilateral rectilinear figure. But according to Kant, not all or even most mathematical judgments are even analytic. Many, he observes, are synthetic. A synthetic judgment is any claim that attributes a property to an object that does not apply to that object by definition. For example, the judgment the triangle is red is synthetic because it sews up or synthesizes the concept of a triangle with a property that is foreign to it. Kant's monumental observation is that mathematicians somehow treat a large variety of synthetic judgments about objects as though they were also a priori, which seems like it should be impossible. Take the judgment that the triangle's angles add up to 180. This claim is evidently a priori because we can attribute the property it denotes to any triangle prior to experiencing it with our senses. But Kant contends that it's also synthetic, arguing that to know that the angles of a triangle add up to 180, one must do more than simply analyze the definition of a trilateral rectilinear figure. One must, in addition, represent the way those three straight lines fall in space. One must have an implicit awareness of the structure of space and the way it interacts with things like straightness. If space were to have different properties than it has, than it is presumed to have, if it were not rectilinear, for example, then the claim that the angles of a triangle add up to 180 would not necessarily be true. Indeed, in Gaussian systems which presume curvilinear space, this proposition is false. So just as a judgment like the triangle is red sews up the concept of a triangle with the disparate concept of being red, so does geometry use the medium of space to synthesize the disparate concepts of triangle and 180 degrees. Without an implicit sense of how space is structured, we could not get very far in geometry. Recognizing the role space and other compatible ideas play in geometry and other comparable sciences creates a problem that Kant writes the entire critique to solve. On the one hand, sticking with the current example, our ability to do geometry depends on our ability to represent space. But on the other hand, geometry is supposed to be an a priori science, allowing us to attribute properties to particular objects prior to having experience with them. The problem is, according to common sense and the best philosophers prior to Kant, we develop a representation of space only by having a large variety of experiences with objects in space, abstracting from experiences of, for example, walking around, picking things up, throwing them, to the idea of pure space as the empty container of all these spatial objects. If this were how we developed it, then we could not use our representation of space to apply properties to objects a priori. for it would only be by having many empirical experiences with those very objective properties that we would come to represent space. This would effectively make geometry a highly abstract, but essentially a posteriori science. We would not be able to say the angles of this triangle necessarily must add up to 180 degrees, but only that it is very likely that they do, since this is how triangles have always worked in the past. So if geometry both uses space and is a priori, then we need a new way of understanding space. We need to be able to represent space not a posteriori after having many experiences with objects, but prior to all experience, a priori. And it's not just space. For arithmetic, another a priori science uses time in just the same way geometry uses space. Physics uses not only notions of space and time, but also concepts like cause and effect to make a priori claims about how the objects we experience will necessarily behave. When we observe some event, say thunder rumbling across the sky, we know as a matter of strict necessity that something caused that event, a lightning strike. Nevertheless, it does not pertain to the definition of thunder, a loud boom in the heavens, that it be caused by something. A clap of thunder would still be thunder if nothing caused it. But we do not admit the possibility of thunder or anything else occurring without a cause. So causality is something we apply to events a priori. Where do we acquire an a priori notion of these ideas we apply to objects necessarily, prior to experiencing them, but which do not pertain to objects by definition? Kant's Critique of Pure Reason is an attempt to answer this question. The strategy is to point out something obvious, something everyone already thinks, and then to revolutionize everything anyone has ever thought about it. The world we experience, the world of space and time, causes and effects, is tautologously a world we experience. None of the objects we encounter, know anything about, or can even conceivably want to know anything about, fall outside the range of what we can experience. That's the obvious thing. Kant's revolutionary idea is that experience is necessary not only to us as our way of accessing the world, but also to the objects we experience, so that those objects themselves would not be possible if we could not experience them. Forecasting the way in which it will explain the possibility of synthetic a priori knowledge of the type geometry yields, Kant introduces this theory that objects around us are possible just if they conform to the conditions of our experience with a famous astronomical metaphor. So this quote is in your handout under the title, The Copernican Turn. He writes, "Up to now, it has been assumed that all our cognition must conform to the objects, but all attempts to find out something about them a priori through synthesis have on this presupposition come to nothing. Hence, let us once try whether we do not get farther by assuming that the objects must conform to our cognition, which would agree better with the requested possibility of an a priori cognition of them, which is to establish something about objects before they are given to us. This would be just like the first thoughts of Copernicus, who, when he did not make good progress in the explanation of the celestial motions, if he assumed that the entire celestial host revolves around the observer, tried to see if he might not have greater success if he made the observer revolve and left the stars at rest. After struggling to make sense of the celestial motions he observed overhead, finding that no renovations of the geocentric mathematics could satisfy reason, Copernicus dared to ask the question with which his name is now synonymous. What if the motion we observe originates not in the stars themselves, but in us? What if we ourselves contribute the motion we see in the moving objects? Kant's idea is just the same as Copernicus's, except instead of stars, he's interested simply in objects. And instead of motion, what he observes are things like spatio-temporal situation and sensitivity to causality. But the proposal is identical. What if space, time, and causality originate not in the spatio-temporal, causally sensitive objects themselves, but rather in us? If the Copernican metaphor is too lofty, the suggestion is that we think of an object of experience as a sort of stew, comprising a variety of ingredients sourced from different places. Some of the most important ingredients, for example, space, time, and causality, come from us. We do not simply consume the stew, passively taking in the objects of experience. we also contribute to cooking it. The essential ingredients of the object that we contribute are called transcendental conditions. Kant's proposal that we take ourselves to contribute transcendental conditions to the possibility of experience is called transcendental idealism. The utility of transcendental idealism, and the only reason anyone should believe it, is that it provides a ready answer to the question of how we represent things like space and time and causality a priori. We have access to these transcendental conditions before experiencing the objects to which they apply because they originate in us. They apply necessarily, not accidentally, to all the objects we experience because we bring them necessarily to all the objects we encounter. Thus, sciences like geometry, which run through space, retain their a priori because space is something we add to the stew of experience, so that it thereby applies necessarily, not accidentally, to all the objects that could possibly come before us. Transcendental ingredients or conditions fall into two genres, which track the ways we have experience of objects. Hewing very close to tradition, Kant presumes we represent objects in two heterogeneous ways. When I represent something like a chair, I have on the one hand a sensible encounter with the particular stuff before my senses. I see it, feel it, smell it, etc. And on the other hand, I think the concept of chair, which applies not only to this particular stuff before me, but also to an indefinite number of other objects which go by the same name. Thus, I represent both sensible intuitions and concepts of the understanding, and knowing an object consists in correctly lining up the former with the latter. Since I experience objects through both sense and thought, both these faculties make transcendental contributions to the possibility of experience. The main sensible conditions I, the subject, contribute are space and time. That's why it's a necessary fact about every object I experience that it be spatio-temporal. The conceptual conditions I contribute are called the categories, which include the concept of causality. Causality is a concept. It's not something I experience with my senses. I can't see or touch it, but I still assume that everything around me must have a cause. And I'm entitled to this assumption because I myself contribute causality to experience. Other categories are concepts of reality, negation, possibility, actuality, and necessity. These are ideas I use and must use to describe the world around me in scientific terms, but like causality, they have their source in me. I'll spend the rest of this lecture discussing Kant's argument that these pure concepts, these categories, apply necessarily to the objects of experience. That argument is called the transcendental deduction. So section two, the transcendental deduction of the categories. So this is gonna use mostly the latter half of the handout under section two, the transcendental deduction of the categories. So I'll kind of go through that material. The first thing to appreciate about the categories is that they are concepts, and concepts before they are anything else are things we think about. To stick with the current example, while causality may be a real world force applying to the real objects in the world, it's also a sophisticated idea that lives in our heads. Though we make sense of the world in terms of causality, we do not actually see, hear, or touch it. We see lightning and then hear thunder, but we use our minds to infer that the former caused the latter. This fact is profoundly alarming to thinkers like Hume, who believe the insensible nature of causality, the fact that it's just something we think about, implies that it may not be real. But Kant takes this as a speculative opportunity. He agrees that causality is, first and foremost, a rule governing our thought of the world, but he believes he can show that the world itself is constrained to follow the rules by which we necessarily think about it. The task is twofold. He needs to show first that thinking is indeed governed by certain knowable rules, rules like causality, and second, that objects are constrained to follow the rules by which we think about them. He begins to address the first of these tasks by making one of the most important observations in the critique. Namely, the most minimal unit of intelligible thought is not, as is commonly assumed, the individual word or concept, but the complete sentence or judgment. As Kant puts it, quote, "We can trace all actions of the understanding back to judgments so that the understanding in general can be represented as a faculty for judging," close quote. As for individual words or concepts, quote, the understanding can make no use of them than that of judging by means of them, close quote. The common sense way to explain meaning is to suggest that it begins with acts of eidomic naming. One points to an object and utters its distinctive name. Dog, cat, fish, runs, eats, is, blue, green. One supposedly first understands these words and only then grasps the sentences they compose when strung together. But Kant denies this view. One of his major innovations is the claim that sentence meaning is prior to word meaning. One first understands sentences like the cat eats fish and then grasps the individual words cat, fish, and eats in terms of the impact they make on the sentence as a whole and other sentences. What we understand when we understand an individual word or concept is the role it plays in complete sentences. Later on, I'll discuss Kant's reasoning for this view, which is among his most influential, inspiring thinkers like Wittgenstein and Frege to associate meaning with use. But we can get a pretty good sense of its plausibility by considering the many thousands of words we know against the tiny subset for which we are prepared to give a dictionary definition. Knowing what a word means typically consists in knowing how to use it in a sentence. Only in very artificial spelling bee-like conditions does it involve explicating its precise denotation. And even this works through the utterance of complete sentences. The utility of this thesis is that it allows Kant to come up with a finite set of rules that govern the activity of thought. For he reasons, while there are no rules restricting the way words may be formulated, there are such rules governing the construction of sentences. Something like grammar is possible with respect to judgment. So if thinking always runs through sentences and sentences are governed by the rules of grammar, it follows that thinking too is in a certain sense grammatical. The grammar Kant has in mind is not that of any particular language, not the rules of German, English, or Greek, for example, but a kind of metagrammar that governs the construction of sentences as such in any language whatsoever. Whether or not this sort of metagrammar is really possible is worth considering. The rules of this metagrammar are defined by what Kant calls the logical functions of judgment. Delineating these functions in a table under four headings, Kant argues that every sentence must exhibit a quantity, quality, relation, and modality. Take the sentence, if lightning strikes, thunder will sound. It exhibits a universal quantity because it ranges over every object that counts as lightning, an affirmative quality because it affirms rather than denies that some property pertains to the class of objects, to this class of objects, a hypothetical relation because it is an if-then rather than a simple declarative or disjunctive either-or sentence, and a necessary modality because it asserts that a certain event necessarily will, according to a rule, follow upon another. Kant contends that every intelligible sentence, every sentence that means anything, exhibits a form delineated by these logical functions of judgment. Since thinking always runs through sentences, these functions constitute the universal laws of thought. So that table is actually on the other side of the handout, just under the title, if you want to consult that. The next step for Kant is to prove that these universal laws apply not only to thought, but also to the objects thought thinks, tables and chairs, etc. The claim is that it is not only the sentences we speak about, but also the objects, or sorry, not only the sentences we speak, but also the objects we speak about that are answerable to the metagrammar of logic. As rules of thinking, the rules of the metagrammar are called logical functions of judgment. But as rules of objects, they will be called categories. Kant's surprising claim is that the grammatical rule enabling us to form hypothetical if-then sentences is in fact the source of the causal relations in nature that those sentences describe. The categories and the logical functions of judgment are the same rules with two different roles to play, and so two different ways of being named. That's why the tables have the same structure, the logical functions of judgment and the categories. Kant's proof that the metagrammar governing judgment at the same time governs nature is called the transcendental deduction of the categories. The argument of the deduction is famously difficult to understand. There are two main reasons why this is so. First, it redefined nearly every relevant term that it discusses in ways that are not wholly conspicuous. Words like thinking, I, and especially object all mean something different at the end than they did at the beginning. Second, the argument is not formally linear or deductive in any recognizable way. Instead, at least as I will present it, it comprises four concentric layers of reasoning in which inner layers articulate the simple logical core of what outer layers make conceptually explicit. As such, understanding the deduction involves both tracking the lexical shifts that it institutes and distinguishing the argument's inner, logically primary layers from its outer, explicating ones. I'll begin with inner layers and progress outwards. So if we, I realize I'm seeing in the chat that some people don't have the handout, so I apologize for that. We weren't able to post it. But for those who do, and for those who don't, maybe we can talk about it in the question period, it wasn't clear. But for those who do, let's look on the second page under the transcendental deduction of categories. So the first most important layer of the deduction makes the case that representing anything at all entitles me to represent myself as the one doing the representing, showing the possibility of self-recognition to be built into experience at the ground floor. I'll present the bones of this argument in a formal demonstration. I think Mr. David Carl is suggesting I'll screen share. Yeah, would you mind doing that, Walter or Mr. Sterling? Putting up the first layer on the back of the handout, if that's clear. Yeah, I don't have sharing abilities either. Are you there, Mr. Sterling?
Yes, my apologies. I'll go ahead and. Did you want me to share it or did you want to share it? I was trying to troubleshoot in a different way.
Yeah, no worries. I think I can't share it for some reason. Would you mind doing that?
I can enable you, which I've done, but I'll also go ahead. Okay.
Oh yeah, I see, I can do it. Great, cool. So step one, this guy, can people see that? I guess people can't talk.
Yeah,
great. So the first most important layer of the deduction makes the case that representing anything at all entitles me to represent myself as the one doing the representing, showing the possibility of self-recognition to be built into experience at the ground floor. I'll present the bones of this argument in a formal demonstration found in your handout and then go through its argument more slowly. So the first layer is titled The Necessary Possibility of Self-Consciousness. Step one. Everything I may experience of the world must be able to appear to me. Step two, appearances are appearances just if they appear to me, the subject of experience. Therefore, experience must be so constituted as to allow me to represent, become conscious of myself through it, since in representing myself, I represent the conditions under which experience appears. This argument introduces Kant's basic theory of self-consciousness. It relies on a tautology. My experience as a whole is by definition something I experience. This is to say, it is essential, not accidental, to the idea of experience that it appear to me. To indicate this necessary relation to me, the subject of experience, Kant calls the contents of experience appearances. Appearances have a recurve built into them. Since an appearance appears, by definition, to me, it follows that my immediate representation of any appearance whatsoever, sights, sounds, smells, always licenses a further representation of myself as the one to whom those appearances appeared. For example, if what appears to me is a flash of lightning, it is necessary that I be able to represent not only that lightning appearance, but also myself as the one to whom it appeared. Representation is a two-sided affair, consisting in both the direct representation of appearances and the mediate, reflexive representation of myself as the one to whom those appearances appear. All representation leads inexorably to self-recognition, self-consciousness, or as Kant will call it, apperception. The second layer of the deduction puts this general theory of self-consciousness to work in a particular case. It proceeds as follows. this is titled The Unity of Self, Manifoldness of Sense. So one, what immediately appears to me in experience is a manifold of sensible intuitions. Two, but I myself constitute a self-identical unity, a being who is constantly equal to itself. Three, therefore the manifold of sensible intuitions must conform to the unity which I myself am. This argument applies the results of the first layer to the particular case of our sensible experience, proving that the manifold that appears to our senses must nevertheless conform to unity because we ourselves, the ones to whom the manifold appears, are unities. Understanding the argument of this layer primarily involves appreciating its two premises, marked with P's. The first premise states that what immediately appears to me in experience are sensible intuitions, sights, sounds, smells, textures, tastes, etc. Sensations, however, suffer the peculiar constraint that they must be given to us as manifolds. I may sense only objects that exhibit differential elements, a black figure on a white paper, but not a white figure on a white paper, a loud sound against a quiet background, etc. Thus, I never experience one sensible intuition without others. When I sense anything at all, I represent a manifold of sensible differentia, apprehending each element of this complex by juxtaposing it to others. By contrast, however, the second premise states that I, the self to whom this sensible manifold appears, am identical with myself. Think Descartes. No matter the diversity of my experiences, it's always the same me doing the experiencing. From the beginning to the end of my life, I could change everything about myself, the way I look, where I live, the people I associate with, and every single opinion I hold. But this utterly changed being will still be the same me as before. This me underlying everything I think and perceive does not change. It is ever self-identical, or at least that's what we represent it as being. So what appears immediately in experience is a sensible manifold, but the self to whom this manifold appears is a thoroughgoing unity. According to the argument of the first layer, this means that I must be able to retrieve a representation of unity from the sensible manifold that appears. For in order to appear, appearances must allow me, the one to whom they appear, to represent myself through them. Since what appears is sensible manifoldness, while I myself am a unity, I must be able to recuperate a representation of a certain unity, namely my own, from my representation of manifoldness. Despite its necessary complexity, sensible experience can never be so manifold that I entirely lose myself within its delirium. Even though I can only sense differences, though only differences appear, I must always be able to trace a path back to myself and my own unity, for otherwise the sensible differences themselves would fail to appear. Thus, while the first layer proves that appearances always enable self-consciousness, the second layer establishes that for this very reason, the sensible manifold conforms necessarily to the unity I myself am. The third layer of the deduction, where I'm circling my mouse around, begins to explain what it means for appearances to conform to the unity I represent myself as being, making the case that self-recognition must always be conceptual, so that everything that appears to me conforms to concepts insofar as by the first layer, it must enable self-recognition. Here are its bones. One, self-recognition must employ a non-sensible type of representation. For rather than adding sensible content to experience, self-recognition represents something about the way the manifold of sensible appearances appear. Namely, to me, in accordance with the unity I myself am. We human beings are capable of only two types of representation, sensible intuitions and concepts of the understanding, thinking. Therefore, concepts of the understanding are the non-sensible avenues by which self-consciousness is enacted. In conforming to the unity that I myself am, given manifolds of sensible appearances conform to concepts. The argument of this layer is that my self-representation through given sensible appearances cannot itself be sensible and must therefore be conceptual. I do not sense, but rather think or conceive myself through what I sense. Adopting the traditional view discussed earlier, Kant presumes that human beings may represent the world in only two ways, through the senses and through thinking. The argument attempts to establish that the subject cannot represent herself through sense, which implies that she must use concepts to do so. The reasoning relies on the mediacy of self-consciousness. According to the line so far developed, the self is never directly conscious of herself in the way she might be of the color red when she has a red object before her. She is conscious of herself only mediately through the sensible manifolds that immediately appear to her. Self-consciousness represents the condition under which sensible manifolds appear, the fact that they must appear to the self. Self-representation cannot add more sensible content to experience, because if it did, it would call for a further act of self-representation to specify the condition of this added content's appearance, leading to an infinite regress of self-representation. Thus, the self must represent herself, but she cannot do so by means of sensible intuition. She must therefore use a non-sensible power of representation, thinking. Much of the payoff of this layer is found in the corollary. We know already that sensible manifolds must universally license the self's representation or consciousness of herself, since otherwise they would not appear. Now we see that since the self represents herself by means of concepts, all sensible manifolds must in some way conform to concepts. Furthermore, since the self represents herself as a unity, while concepts are the avenues of that self-representation, it follows that sensible manifolds, in conforming to concepts, also conform to unity. Concepts are, in this way, mechanisms for instituting unity within the manifoldness of sensible experience. Appreciating the monumental significance of this result involves understanding a little more about concepts. Kant's theory of concepts may be productively compared to Plato's. Like Plato, Kant thinks concepts articulate the essences of objects that allow us to say what they are, to gather their complex elements under the form of one object, and to identify a universal species under which other objects of this kind fall. When I encounter some particular object, say a couch, I experience a complex of sensible elements, different textures, many colors, characteristic sounds, etc. But despite this, I still represent the object before me as one thing, namely one single couch. I'm able to do that because I gather the sensible differentia together under the concept or idea of a couch, which confers unity on the complexity. The concept also allows me to unify this particular couch before me with other couches, taking each to exemplify and individuate the same universal essence. Whenever we name an object, couch, tree, church, we do so by means of its concept or essence, appealing to the universal idea that allows us to both call the object one, despite its disparate elements, and assimilate that object to other particulars of its kind. What Kant is really arguing in this third layer, then, is that the objects we encounter in experience come by the essences that make them what they are by conforming to me and my act of self-consciousness. Whenever I understand an object as what it is, what I'm really doing is looping my representation of myself through the sensible manifold that appears to me, thereby conferring unity on it and lining it up with the concept that makes it what it is. In other words, the conceptual unity that sensible manifolds exhibit insofar as they enable my self-representation is nothing other than the essence of the object that is thereby constituted. What, for example, the idea of a couch is to any particular couch. The difference between Kant's and Plato's theories of concepts, then, consists not primarily in the role concepts play with respect to objects. Both philosophers think concepts confer essences on objects, but rather in the origin of those concepts. Whereas Plato thinks essences or forms originate in a metaphysical firmament accessible to us through recollection and applying to objects as a matter of divine decree, Kant thinks concepts have their source in us, applying to objects through acts of self-consciousness. So the third layer of the deduction tells us that conceptual articulation is built into the very possibility of experience. In order to appear, appearances must conform to the possibility of my self-recognition. I recognize myself by means of concepts, so all appearances conform to concepts. But proving that experience is necessarily conceptual does not tell us anything about which concepts are available to us a priori. It is the job of the fourth and final layer of the deduction to reveal a certain stable set of concepts that apply to all sensible objects necessarily, so not just couches or chairs, so that they are available to us a priori in our investigations about the world. The categories. Here are the bones of the argument. One, concepts are essentially, not accidentally, components of judgments or sentences. This is that part of the argument. Two, judgments may be formulated only in accordance with their logical functions. Three, therefore, in conforming to concepts, sensible manifolds conform to these logical functions. Corollary, when the logical functions of judgment apply to sensible manifolds rather than judgments or sentences, they are called categories. The argument here is that since concepts are functions of judgment and judgments are constructible only in accordance with their logical forms, sensible experience must answer to these forms as rules precisely because it must conform to concepts. The logical functions of judgment are now shown to perform two jobs, governing not only judgments, but also sensible experience. So they get a second name corresponding to their second task. As rules of sensible experience, i.e. laws of nature, they are called categories. Kant's claim is deceptively simple. If it is accepted that individual concepts, words, are components of complete sentences necessarily, so that the sentence remains the most minimal unit of thought, and it is also accepted that sentences may be formulated only in accordance with a finite set of rules, then it follows that not only concepts, but also the sensible manifolds that conform to concepts must also conform to these rules. The rules governing sentence formation are the logical functions of judgment, so both concepts and the sensible manifolds that necessarily conform to them are governed by these functions. And the functions are called categories insofar as they pertain to sense. To get a concrete idea of what Kant is arguing here, consider two of the logical functions of judgment and their corresponding categories. The following are functions and categories of relation. So let's look at this table here, the last of the handout. The logical functions on the left column designate two of the three relations of judgment, relations judgments may exert between subject and object. Categorical or simple declarative sentences state that something is or is not the case. Examples include, the painting is red, the statue is tall, Bill has warts. In each of these sentences, some simple state of affairs is said to pertain. If we consult the corresponding categories on the right column, we see that the relation asserted in a categorical judgments is the same one that holds between a substance and its property. Kant's claim then is that the world sorts into substances and properties because the functions of judgment require us to form sentences with this form. Similarly, hypothetical or if-then sentences assert a relation between a condition and an outcome. Examples include, if I trip, I'll get hurt. If lightning strikes, thunder will sound. If I graduate from St. John's College, I'll be wise. This hypothetical relation is what holds between cause and effect. Tripping is the cause of getting hurt, thunder the effect of lightning, graduating from St. John's the cause of wisdom. And again, Kant's point is that the world sorts into causes and effects because the logical functions require us to form hypothetical sentences in this way. Kant's claim in the deduction is that we are entitled to abstract concepts like causality, substance, property, and the like, because these concepts reflect basic rules of sentence formation by which all judgments about the world must abide. We are entitled to presume that these pure concepts or categories apply universally in experience because everything that appears must conform to my thinking. Thinking always runs through judgment, and all judgments are constrained by these rules. It is not only that I've never encountered an effect without a cause or a property without a substance, it's rather that it's impossible for such a thing to occur because they violate the rules of thought, disrupting the pathways by which I recognize myself in experience. When the subject experiences the world, becoming aware of its objects, cognizing tables, chairs, and lightning strikes, what she is primarily doing, according to Kant, is recuperating her own unity from the delirium of sense. Whenever she lines up given sensible objects with the concepts that make them what they are, she does so by recognizing the fact that these objects are given to her and must conform to the unity she takes herself to be. Every act of cognition is the outcome of a round of self-recognition, and all concepts by which the subject represents and understands the world are reflections of the unity by which she understands herself. Stop the share here, because that's the end of the handout. Section 3, rational culpability and accounting for oneself. What is self-consciousness? So I just want to issue a disclaimer going forward through the end of this talk that there's plenty controversial in what's come before, but in a way it's closer to a kind of central, down the center reading of Kant. What's coming after is more controversial. So get out your boxing gloves. The goal of this penultimate section is to make the results of the deduction of the transcendental deduction more concrete. The strategy of the deduction was first to prove that the self must be able to recognize herself through everything that appears in her experience, and then to layer constraints on how that self-recognition may take place. Ultimately, showing the possibility of self-consciousness to require experience to be governed by the law of the categories. But what does self-consciousness really involve? What is the self really doing when she recognizes herself through given appearances as the one to whom those appearances appear? I'd like to suggest that she is accepting responsibility for herself and her representations, becoming accountable for the correctness of those representations. Self-consciousness consists not in a dumb awareness of oneself, but in acknowledging rational culpability for how one represents the world. To explain what I mean here, I'll take a scenic route by returning to Kant's claim that the judgment, or the complete sentence, is the smallest unit of intelligible thought, so that we must understand individual words through the judgments they compose. This was a pivotal premise in the deduction, but why does Kant believe it? The basis for this view is Kant's realization of the essentially active character of thinking. Whereas my sensations originate in the objects I sense, my thoughts originate in me. In Kant's terms, while sensibility is receptive, thinking is spontaneous. Any performance attributable to me and my spontaneity is one for which I, rather than the externally affective world, may be held responsible. I am the one who produced the performance. I am its source. A performance in the realm of thinking is some sort of claim about the way objects are. To be responsible for such a performance, I suggest, is to be responsible for its correctness. I am responsible for what I say in the sense that I may be blamed if it turns out to be false. I sign my name to the truth of my utterances. If thinking is something active, something I do, then the performances in which it results must be of the type that may be either correct or incorrect. For otherwise, I could not be responsible for them. And if I could not be responsible for them, they could not count as my deeds, the results of spontaneity. Now, the utterance of an isolated concept cannot be correct or incorrect. I cannot be wrong when I simply say dog, red, or enlightenment without context, without pointing to anything. But when I inscribe these words in even minimal sentences, this is a dog, this is red, this is enlightenment, I produce utterances that may or may not be correct and for which I may therefore be held responsible. I can be blamed if it turns out that this is not a dog, not red, not enlightenment. For in such cases, it's as if I have broken a promise. The world is not as I portrayed it as being. When I utter a complete sentence, any one, I commit myself in a particular way, contending that this and not that is the case, assuming responsibility for a particular presentation of the facts. Since this is so, since sentences or judgments are the minimal utterances to which I may be committed, and so the smallest sayings for which I may be held responsible, they are also the most minimal utterances properly attributable to me as originating in me, not elsewhere. So since thought must originate in me, be spontaneous, judgment is the smallest unit of thinking. Appreciating this relation between responsibility and judgment is, I think, the key to understanding the theory of self-consciousness we saw Kant put forward in the deduction. Whenever I represent some object by means of a judgment, asserting, for example, that this is a stray dog, I represent not only the manifold before my senses, a brown color, a mangy smell, a barking noise, but also myself as the one who issues it and is responsible for the claim. since I am the one who asserted it, I am the one who is on the hook to defend its correctness if someone challenges it. Whenever I represent sensible objects by making claims about how and what they are, I also implicitly represent myself as the one who is responsible for the correctness of those representations. My act of acknowledging responsibility for my judgments is, according to Kant, what my self-consciousness most basically consists in. When I represent myself by representing that given appearances appear by definition to me, I do not simply become passively aware of myself, I rather recognize myself as the one who actively represents sensible appearances by making claims about them that may or may not be correct. In other words, I represent myself just if I acknowledge the responsibility I bear for the way I judge the world to be. I am conscious of myself exclusively as a center of culpability for what I say and do. If this is right, if self-consciousness consists in acknowledging one's responsibility for one's judgments, the next question is, what does it really take to bear responsibility for oneself? What does the self have to do in order to be thereby taking responsibility for, and so recognizing herself in, her judgments? Taking responsibility for a judgment's correctness, I suggest, involves acknowledging accountability for justifying that correctness in the face of appropriate challenge. One is on the hook to vindicate the claim one makes if pressed. Justifying a claim standardly involves asserting further claims which stand to the given one as reasons for endorsing it. If I judge that this is a stray dog, I might justify my assertion if challenged by stating, "You agree that this animal barks and only dogs do that. And if this animal had an owner, he wouldn't be all alone, but you agree that he is." These further judgments provide reasons for endorsing the original one. Anyone committed to the reasons ought also to be committed to the original claim that this is a stray dog. Giving reasons is the paradigmatic form of justification. Even pointing at the dog to prove it's a dog is trying to provide the challenger with a reason for endorsing the contested claim. What the subject commits herself to doing when she acknowledges responsibility for her judgments, then, is to provide reasons for endorsing those judgments if appropriately challenged. This analysis of justification allows us to be a little clearer about what self-recognition really involves. Notice that the reasons for accepting that the dog is astray function by demonstrating an incompatibility in the challenger's total constellation of beliefs. He believes the animal in question barks, which only dogs do. He also believes that it wouldn't be alone if it were not astray. If he does not, for these reasons, believe that the animal is a stray dog, then he is not compatible with himself. Providing reasons to a challenger always serves the goal of demonstrating that, given the judgments he already endorses, he cannot retain commitment to his own unity without accepting the judgment under dispute. Denying the disputed judgment but accepting the provided reasons amounts to accepting that the very same state of affairs both is and is not the case. And doing that effectively slices the challenger in two, rupturing his unity with himself, so that one half of him believes one thing while the other half believes the opposite. To be a unified self is to self-consciously hold only compatible beliefs about how things are. The flip side of this is that when the self asserts a judgment, acknowledging responsibility for justifying its correctness, she implies that the given judgment does fit compatibly with all the other beliefs she has about the world, that these other beliefs at worst do not contradict the given one and at best provide reasons for endorsing it. To judge that anything at all is the case is to have some implicit awareness of the total constellation of one's beliefs, of other beliefs to which one is committed, and a conviction that the current judgment hangs together with these others in a compatible unity. Judgment requires acknowledging responsibility not only for the single judgment one asserts, but also for all the judgments to which one is currently committed, affirming that all these claims hang together in a mutually affirming unity with one another. The upshot of this is that self-consciousness, which consists in acknowledging oneself as responsible for one's judgment, comes down to an affirmation of one's own unity, just as Kant claimed in the deduction. In acknowledging responsibility for a judgment, endorsing its correctness, I affirm that this judgment fits compatibly with all the others to which I am also committed, constituting a constellation of coordinated beliefs that a unified self may endorse simultaneously while retaining her identity. When I sign my name to a judgment, affirming its correctness, I contend that it is consistent with the unity with the unity I myself am, affirming that it fits rationally together with everything I'm committed to. That's why for Kant, apperception always affirms the total unity of experience. Whenever the subject recognizes herself, she affirms that the complete network of judgments that describe experience as a whole and to which she herself is committed constitutes a compatible interlocking system. Self-consciousness comes down to rational culpability. When we represent ourselves, we represent nothing other than our task responsibility to make all our judgments about the world rationally coherent. The self-identity characteristic of the subject describes not the indivisibility of a necessary substance, but the unbreakable commitment to a unified world of experience. Apperception amounts most basically to an awareness of our distinctive responsibility to reasons, to rationally defending everything we believe, say, and do by showing it to be made necessary by everything else we believe, say, and do. The categories themselves, the avenues of self-consciousness, should be viewed as the baseline conditions a judgment must fulfill if it is to stand to others as a reason or relate to others which are reasons for it. If a judgment does not follow these rules, then it cannot fit together rationally with others. And so the subject cannot take responsibility for it, which means its content cannot, in the end, appear to her. Section 4, the world without us. What is the thing in itself? To conclude this talk, I'd like to address a question about Kant's theory of knowledge that may be lingering for some. Kant has made the case, or I've made Kant make the case, that the most structurally important aspects of objects are contributed by us, joining up with, for example, space, time, and causality by appearing to us. Doesn't that make experience a kind of hall of illusions? If the most important traits by which we know objects really come from us, doesn't that mean we can't know objects as they really are? Wouldn't a truly scientific knowledge attempt to know the object not as it appears to us, but as it is in itself? Although Kant's answer is a decided no, he predicts these questions in the critique and makes some attempt to address them with his distinction between appearances and things in themselves. Instead of directly refuting the accusation that transcendental idealism makes our experience sit on top of or even occlude the real world, Kant's strategy is to use his argument from the deduction to explain that while the idea of things in themselves, that is, objects that do not conform to our cognition, is necessary, the object of this idea has no basis in reality or no necessary basis in reality. The tactic is akin to the kind of political dodge we see every day. Imagine a senator accusing the president of being a communist. Rather than refuting the claim, the president might retaliate by charging the senator with being a McCarthy-style red baiter. By this, the president would imply that while the senator thinks he, the president, is a communist, this is just because red baiters like him think that about everyone. In this way, the president attempts to undermine the accusation by showing it to be grounded not in the facts of the matter, but in the particular constitution of his accuser. Given the way the senator thinks about the world, his accusation was in fact necessary. Everyone looks like a communist to a red baiter. Kant's strategy with the thing in itself is analogous to this dodge. His attempt is to show our thought of the thing in itself to be grounded not in the facts, not in how things really are, but in our own constitution, in the way we think about the world. To make this claim, he returns to the deduction. It is necessary to this argument, and so to Kant's entire critical viewpoint, that the concepts by which we think objects be rigorously distinct from the intuitions by which we sense them. For concepts, recall, are functions of self-consciousness, and self-consciousness must employ a nonsensible type of representation. See the third layer of the deduction for a review of this claim, if you happen to have the handout. If concepts are different from sense, then they must be able to conceive something other than sensible objects. But since the only objects at hand are sensible ones, then concepts must consider those objects of sensible appearance as they are beyond their appearance to the senses, that is, as they are in themselves. Thinking an object purely according to its concept, abstracting it from its sensible appearance, amounts to thinking something akin to the pure Platonic form of that object. Recall that for Kant, as for Plato, concepts articulate the essences of the objects they determine. When we consider an object of experience purely according to its concept, and so as it is in itself beyond its conformity to the senses, we take ourselves to be conceiving a deeper, more essential reality. But while the thought of objects as they are in themselves is necessary, it is not necessary that the objects of those necessary thoughts actually exist. The necessity of the thought is grounded in us, not in the facts. We must conceive the objects of experience not only as they appear, but also as they are in themselves, simply because we're equipped with two ways of representing the world, through sense and through concepts. So just like the red-baiting senator is bound to see communists behind every politician because of who he is and how he sees the world, so are we bound to see things in themselves behind all the objects of experience because of who we are and how we see the world. We may consider the thing in itself as an almost ironic term. Our most necessary thought is of something that does not necessarily exist. Although there's nothing stopping it from existing either, the president could be a communist in the end, but that's not why he was accused. The concept of such a thing is compulsory, but only as an accidental artifact of the transcendental device. Kant views the world as something in which the human being is essentially, not accidentally involved. Without us, without our commitment to bearing responsibility for ourselves, accepting culpability for everything we do, say, and believe, so as to thereby become conscious of ourselves, nothing would be possible. The idea of a world without us is necessary, but in the end, it's just an idea. End.
Thank you so much, Mr. Slover, and thanks for working through sharing the handout.
Sure.
I just put in the chat thread the link for the question period, and we hope many of you will join us. And as I indicated, doing it in the Zoom meeting environment allows it to be quite dynamic and comparable to what we normally have for a question period. So we will resume there in about 5 minutes, though I'll open the meeting as soon as we close this. And just please join me in thanking Mr. Slover from your distant perches for sharing these reflections with us tonight. Thank you, Kit. Sure.